Immigrants try to hook up with Obamacare. Today, Wednesday, October 30th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's all healthcare all the time, and the frustrations aren't just with the website. Today, trying to help immigrants who don't speak English connect with Obamacare.
Affordable healthcare. Affordable healthcare. It's Obamacare.
Also today, the scars of war around Damascus.
Once you drive around what's called here the flyover that goes around the city, you're able to see the bombardment on these rebel enclaves. You actually hear the explosions.
Also, a Norwegian engineer's Bitcoin bounty plus a lesson in beatboxing.
Okay.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. One issue above all others on President Obama's mind today, health care. The president himself flew here to Boston to speak up in defense of the Affordable Health Care Act. And earlier, his top health aide was on Capitol Hill, accepting responsibility for the botched rollout of healthcare.gov. She called it a debacle. Everyone seems to agree. The malfunctioning website has frustrated millions of people trying to sign up for Obamacare. Well, at least they know about it. Some immigrant communities here have yet to even hear about the insurance plan. Reporter Akiko Fujita followed one immigrant canvasser trying to sign up the uninsured.
Nina Sharman sets up shop at a restaurant in Los Angeles in a neighborhood called Little Bangladesh. People here come to feast on Bengali food while watching the news from South Asia on a grainy TV screen. Sharman's been coming here every Wednesday lately, not for the food, but to become a familiar face so she can talk to people about health care.
They will not talk with the stranger, no. They will not share anything. So what it will be? They'll be without health insurance, or when they'll get the penalty, maybe that time they will be panic what they can do, you know. So I'm worried about this community.
She's talking about the Bangladeshi community, one of California's fastest growing immigrant groups. More than 6,000 live in L.A. Many are low income and uninsured, and they have never heard of the term Obamacare.
They have no clue, you know, what they can do. Like, you know, it's really, really they need help. Hello, Bobby.
To loop people in and get them insured, Sharman works as a health advocate for the South Asian Network, a nonprofit. It has people like Sharman heading to restaurants, shops, homes, going door to door, explaining the Affordable Care Act. They're part of a wider force of nearly two dozen groups canvassing California's vast Asian immigrant community to talk health care. Sharman enters homes and hands out pamphlets about healthcare in South Asian languages like Hindi, Urdu, and Bangla. It helps that Sharman and her colleagues aren't considered strangers around here. It keeps people from shutting the door on someone they think might just be out to swindle. Here's the South Asian Network's executive director, Manju Kulkarni.
There is often a real concern about corruption and about scams that people might be undertaking in the community.
As Sharman moves through the neighborhood, an older man pulls her aside. He says that he and his wife have Medi-Cal, but his daughters aren't covered. He asks about Obama's new plan. Sharman pulls out a pamphlet and explains who's eligible under the Affordable Care Act. She offers to meet the man again to help fill out the application. It's 32 pages long. Kulkarni at the South Asian Network knows that many immigrants want health care, but they hit language barriers in an already complicated system.
Getting access to the doctor for the first time or being able to take their kids to the dentist, these are really important things for them and part of what they see as the American dream.
It's a stark contrast to conditions back home. Most South Asian countries don't offer comprehensive health care coverage, and systems are known for corruption. But getting care in the U.S. is hardly straightforward. Healthcare advocates say many immigrants don't know what high premiums or pre-existing conditions mean.
You are eligible, right? She is eligible, but she don't know.
Nina Sharman remembers how tough it was when she first came here from Bangladesh 15 years ago. Her son was 3 then and had kidney problems. Insurance for the family cost $500 a month. Sharman ran out of cash in 6.
So think about who is coming to this country just even though they cannot speak English. So what they will do?
As we approach a bus stop near a busy intersection, Sharman spots a woman wearing a headscarf. Sharman asked the usual questions. Do you know about the new healthcare plan? Are you insured? The woman, Parul Khatun, is from Bangladesh, arrived here with her family 2 years ago. She doesn't know about healthcare plans, and she says her young daughter recently fractured her knee. Treatment for that cost the family $40 a month out of pocket. It doesn't seem like much, but the woman tells Sharman that she and her husband are out of work and struggle to make those payments.
Affordable health care. Affordable health care.
Sharman tells Khatun she'll walk her through the new program. She also shares her own story.
When I come to this country, I also same situation. So today I'm here, so I'm okay. I can speak, I can work. And my children is going to school.
Sharman assures the woman and says, one step at a time.
So you can. You too, me parbe.
For the world, I'm Akiko Fujita in Los Angeles.
Okay?
In Iraq, healthcare issues are of a completely different magnitude. Violence has risen to its highest level since 2007. Bombings and bullets kill hundreds of Iraqis each month. But the country's health emergency goes even beyond that. Gil Burnham co-authored a study published earlier this month assessing how many people have died in Iraq over the last 12 years, in other words, before the U.S.-led invasion. Burnham is with the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Gil, tell us what you found.
Well, what we found, of course, was that a number of people died from conflict-related activities, but what really struck us was the increasing number of deaths that were related to indirect causes. That means lack of access to services in some way, and this was a pattern we picked up in 2006 to begin with, but we noticed it increased substantially as time went along.
Right. And so when you say lack of services, what are you talking about? That's kind of indirect deaths.
Yes. Well, it means that hospitals may not function to their full facility. They may not have the medicines. They may not have the doctors, the nurses. The equipment may not be functioning. So it could be a variety of things, or it could be that it's just unsafe to go there.
So have you been able to quantify how many people died from direct death and how many have died from indirect?
Our overall estimate was about 451,000, and so of overall deaths. And so we're estimating that probably around a third of those were excess deaths from indirect causes of conflict.
And are these problems continuing today?
Yes, they are. And unfortunately, while many parts of Iraq have moved ahead, we've seen some progress in the health sector, but there's still many areas of difficulty there.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is heading to Washington this week to meet with President Obama. They'll be talking on security mostly, but I'm wondering if you think public health or how public health might actually figure into the agenda.
Well, without security, people are not going to have access to health services. But from the public health standpoint, the serious damage to the water and sewage systems that occurred during the war, much of that has not been repaired. There's still extended periods of time when much of the country does not have electricity. That's a major issue. And there has been continuing problems with poor nutrition among children in Iraq, although I think some of that is improving. Still having the food security as well as the personal security, I think, would go a long way also to improving the health status of people.
Did you go to Iraq yourself, Gil, to work on this research?
Yes, I've been to Iraq probably 6 or 7 times in various parts. And right now, we're working very much on research projects to reduce the deaths and illness in women and children. And that's a major U.S. AID initiative at the moment.
What struck you about healthcare in Iraq when you were there? I mean, just, you know, something that wouldn't occur to the average American.
Well, What struck me was the high motivation of the people that I met. And these were very dedicated nurses and doctors who've been through really terrible times, lost family members, had colleagues killed or kidnapped, and yet they've stuck through all of this. They have their frustrations, as anybody would, working in a system that's not fully functional. But the dedication to their patients and the dedication to the health of the country, to me, was a very striking message.
Gil Burnham of the Johns Hopkins Center for Global Health, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've heard us talking about bitcoins before. A few weeks back, I think we successfully explained what bitcoins are all about. They are digital currency used for online transactions, and they are decentralized, which means that their value is not tied to a central bank like the Fed. Think digital poker chips. The concept was introduced in 2008. 1 year later, Christopher Koch bought just around $24 worth of the digital currency. Koch is an engineer based in Oslo, in Norway, and recently he had a really pleasant surprise. He discovered that his 24 bucks had turned into a whopping $886,000. Nice. But Christopher says the value of his bitcoins was so low originally, he almost forgot he had them.
Yeah, I think the value when I bought them was like 0.04 or something dollars each. And today, I don't know, like $200 today.
So when did you realize just how much your purchase had risen in value?
It was April this year. It was in the media. They mentioned that it was rapidly increasing in value. So it dawned on me that I had something like this.
So you made this investment in 2009. And then after that, you just kind of ignored the value of bitcoins and just kind of sat there online?
Yeah, I was going on with my life, finishing my master thesis and getting a job and doing my job. And it was kind of in a struggle to find this wallet file, which proves that I can use these coins or whatever.
Right. I mean, there's kind of a nail-biting episode here. You almost didn't get any of your investment back. Explain that.
Yeah, I found a file which I had stored online in a safe place. But being a bit paranoid, I had encrypted this file. So I don't know. Do you remember your passwords from 4 years ago?
Yeah, I know. That's always a tough one. So you didn't remember your password for the investment of those $24 worth of bitcoins a few years ago?
No. So I think I had like 12 hours of trying finding what was this, not only password, but passphrase. So,
did you find a piece of paper with it written down, or did you just kind of try and divine it?
Yeah, no, it came to me in a silent room.
Christopher, do you think a decentralized currency will continue to have traction, or will it even maybe increase as we head into the future?
Maybe it won't be Bitcoin or whatever, but the idea is out, so everyone can understand how it works and implement something like it, or better, improve it.
So let me ask you the real question here, which is now you're kind of got some money in the bank. What are you going to roll that back into? Another smart investment?
No, I'm a technical guy. I don't think money makes you happy, but it can buy you an apartment.
It can also buy you a nice meal. Did you celebrate?
Yeah, multiple times. So.
Okay, good. Well, yeah. At least there's a little payoff, isn't there?
Yeah, it is. It's a good story to tell.
Christopher Koch, engineer and now successful Bitcoin investor, speaking with us from Oslo. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS. And from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We hear about cars running into crowds and blowing up. But those stories come mostly from the Mideast and Afghanistan. The story we're about to tell you comes from China. not just anywhere in China, Tiananmen Square in Beijing. And Chinese police are saying that this car explosion on Monday was a deliberate terrorist attack. At first, officials let out a few details. They even tried to scrub real-time information about the deadly incident as it appeared online. But now they're giving fresh details. The World's Matthew Bell joins me now. So, Matthew, first of all, what exactly happened on Monday?
The first we heard of this, Marco, was on social media. People in Tiananmen Square were taking pictures, and they were saying there's been some kind of accident. There was a car in flames. Police acted very quickly to set up barriers. They even blocked photographers from view. When news reporters went down to the scene, they were detained and prevented from taping or gathering information. So it wasn't so clear what happened, but it seemed like a bad accident. Dozens of people were hurt. Possibly there were deaths.
So that was Monday, and now today Chinese officials have released new fresh details. What are they saying?
Police in Beijing have come out and said that this crash was, quote, a rigorously planned, organized, premeditated, violent terrorist attack. They're not splitting hairs there. They said that five suspects are in custody. Most of the names seem to suggest that they come from Xinjiang, the western region of China, where the ethnic minority group of the Uyghurs come from.
And what does that mean? I mean, what's going on in Western China that they would, if this is the case, drive a car into Tiananmen Square and blow it up?
It's a place where there's, for a long time, have been political tensions and violence between the Uyghurs. Many of them feel that their rights are not represented. The place is called officially an autonomous region, but people from there will tell you that's just a joke, that their rights are not respected. If this did happen, and it was carried out by a group from Xinjiang, I talked to one terrorist expert who studies extremist groups from Central Asia. He said it could be unprecedented, that there has been violence in Xinjiang, but to take this kind of action in a place like Tiananmen Square, this would be unprecedented.
I mean, kind of interesting what I mentioned earlier, that authorities tried to censor some of the original details of what happened on Monday. Do you know what they were sensitive to and what makes this case seemingly such a hot one for the Chinese government?
Again, I think just that spot in Tiananmen Square, to have any sort of indication that the Chinese police and security apparatus is not in control in that very central, important place. I mean, Marco, I was there at Tiananmen Square a year ago, and the number of tourists there, you know, it's like Disneyland in a way. If you go on a tour, you go to Beijing, you definitely go to Tiananmen Square. I mean, this is the last place that the Chinese government wants pictures of mayhem or violence or any sort of, you know, political messiness to be emerging from. They want things to be smooth there. I remember walking through and noticing that some of the security officers there had fire extinguishers sitting right next to them on the ground,
wow,
ready for incidents like this.
So, Matthew, the smart people you speak with say this is unprecedented. The Chinese officials say this is a deliberate terrorism. How big a deal is this?
The connection to Xinjiang is coming from the police, so we have to be careful about speculating in that way. But if it is from a group in Xinjiang, it could represent an escalation. There are extremist groups from that region that have connections to groups like al-Qaeda, to the Taliban in Pakistan, Afghanistan. There's one group called the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, which actually operates in North Waziristan on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, if that kind of global terrorism is sort of rearing its head in the Chinese capital, that is a big deal, and that's something new.
All right, you'll keep us updated. The World's Matthew Bell, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
It's Beatmaking Lab time now. You've heard us talking about it before, right? North Carolina musicians Pierce Freelon and Stephen Levitin are teaching students around the globe how to produce hip-hop beats. Their latest project is in Ethiopia. Freelon and Levitin will be going there soon to check on the students. This week, they issued this challenge to the Beatmaking Lab participants.
Everyone, imagine that you're from a different country or maybe even a different planet from the people around you. The only way you can communicate is by making a sound and a bodily motion. For example, hey, hey. And that's the only way we can communicate with each other. I'll say, hey.
Okay, I can imagine that. People think I'm from a different planet anyway. Stephen Levitin joins us now from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So interesting challenge this week, Stephen. Students had to make one sound and a body gesture to communicate with each other. So what is your sound and your body gesture?
Okay. Okay, now you got to share your sound.
All right. I don't really have anything as sophisticated as that. How about just humana, 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 humana.
So then we got to do it together.
Okay, ready?
And then we got to combine them. All right.
Two, one. Humana, humana. Humana, humana. Humana, humana.
So imagine if we didn't speak the same language, we would be smiling pretty hard right now. I mean, as we are speaking the same language.
I am smiling pretty hard. So what do we get out of this?
It's just a way for us to communicate, for us to be get into a creative open space pretty immediately that, you know, even if we spoke the same language, words can't do.
And it seems to be more than just an icebreaker at this point. This is getting into real beat making, right?
It is getting into beat making. When you sit down at the computer, you're not thinking of scales or theory. You're just thinking of nodding your head to that music in your mind and sounding it out either with your mouth or your hands or, you know, programming it. So this is the first step in getting creative. You have to be in a creative space to make beats. It's like uncomfortable. It's silly. It's fun. And by the end, you know, it feels like we're at summer camp and everyone, you know, loves each other.
And Stephen, remind us just how hardwired beatboxing is to hip hop.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge part of hip hop. Just like DJs scratching on a record, it's beatboxing is a really unique form in hip hop, and it's a really fun way to make music. You don't need to buy anything; you just have your sounds of your mouth and body to make it happen.
Humana, humana. So, what's what's next? When do you head back to Ethiopia?
We head back with IntraHealth in November 10th through the 17th for the family planning conference, and we're going to be reconnecting with Galila and a lot of the students that you've seen in the episodes. We'll be checking in on their progress, the successes, the failures. We're really excited just to see how we can improve and help and support what's going on there.
And we'll be checking in with you one more time before you head off, and also when you're in Addis as well. And let's go out with a little beatboxing from Razel, former member and beatboxer with The Roots, in a track called If Your Mother Only Knew. Stephen Levitin, a.k.a. Applejuice Kid, one half of the team behind the Beatmaking Lab. Thanks a lot, and talk to you soon.
All right, thank you.
If your mother only knew that you was trying to get with me. Your mother only knew.
All of those sounds made without instruments. As always, you can read more about the Beatmaking Lab and see this week's video where the students try a little beatboxing. That's at PRI.org. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, India's chaiwallas versus Starbucks.
We went to the Starbucks here in Delhi, and we asked the waiters there whether they preferred the chai at Starbucks or the ones outside, and they said, no, it's no question. Of course, we take our chai breaks outside. And so then we went out and had a chai with the waiter on his work break.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. How far we've come. Retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor officiated a gay wedding at the Supreme Court this week. Last June, the Supreme Court wrestled with DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and now that seems like a thing of the past. No doubt, America's made great strides in equality for gay people, but it's not that way in many other parts of the world. For example, Chile. 18 months ago, Daniel Zamudio, a gay man living in the capital, Santiago, was beaten by 4 men in a park. They carved swastikas into his skin, burned him with cigarettes, and left him to die. It's reminiscent of the 1998 murder of Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming, and like the tragic story of Shepard, the murder of Daniel Zamudio is changing the conversation about gay rights in Chile. The BBC's Gideon Long joins us from Santiago. The four attackers, Gideon, in the Zamudio case have all been convicted of murder. What is the latest?
They have all been convicted and they were sentenced earlier this week. One of them, who was described by the judge as the main perpetrator of the attack, Patricio Almada, was given a life sentence. Two of the other assailants were given 15 years each, and the fourth man, Fabian Morat, was given a seven-year sentence. Those sentences were issued on Monday this week.
So a lot of people believe Daniel Zamudio's murder has changed Chile, but gay men have been attacked in the country before. What was it about this particular murder that changed things?
I think it was the brutality, the details of which you mentioned. There have been attacks on gay men in the past in Chile, but it was the details of this case that really shocked people. Daniel Zamudio was walking alone in a park late at night in Santiago. He was attacked by the four men. They beat him to the ground, they kicked him, they knocked him unconscious. Then they started to torture him by carving swastikas onto his skin, by smashing his leg with a huge rock. And then, according to some of the graphic court testimony that was released earlier this month, they then urinated on his body before they left him for dead. He was found a few hours later in the park. He was taken to hospital and then he suffered for 3 weeks in hospital before he finally died. So I don't think it's the fact that a gay man was attacked in Santiago that shocked Chileans. It was the nature of the attack.
Wow. What's going on now with the conversation? I mean, the death of Matthew Shepard awoke the U.S. to levels of homophobia in our own backyard that many people didn't realize existed. What has Zamudio's murder and death done in Chile?
Well, I think the most immediate impact was that legislators passed an anti-discrimination law. It specifies that nobody in Chile should be persecuted, not just on grounds of gender, but also on grounds of race and ethnicity. Since then, I think the other big change that we've seen is that gay rights have become an issue in a way that they weren't before. And we've seen this in the current presidential campaign. Chileans go to the polls on November the 17th to choose a new president, and gay rights has been an issue in this election in a way that it simply wasn't in the last election. So there have been serious, significant knock-on effects from Daniel Zamudio's murder.
So give us a sense of just how fast the gay rights movement in Chile has changed. I mean, do you get the sense that Daniel Zamudio's murder is part of a new era of attention to gay rights there?
I think it is. Just to give you an idea, I've been living here for the past 7 years, and when I first arrived, there was no gay pride in Santiago. Now there are gay pride marches every year, and each year there are more people who go on them. So that's one indication of how things are changing.
So just last week, a 21-year-old gay man was beaten up in a small town south of Santiago in Chile. There are reports that the man had one of his eyes cut out. I mean, even with this apparent sea change and the murder of Daniel Zamudio, how far does Chile still have to go?
Well, a long way, and attitudes still have to change a long way. And as you say, this latest attack has again focused minds, and it showed Chileans that they still have work to do. There is some uncertainty about the details of the attack. It just happened 10 days ago in this small town around 60 kilometres south of Santiago. It's not entirely clear if it was a homophobic attack, but it was a young man, 21 years old, who is gay and was known in the town to be gay, who was walking through town during daylight hours, hand in hand with a friend. He was attacked by six people, two of them women. And according to witnesses, they threw homophobic abuse at him. They kicked him to the ground. He is now in a coma fighting for his life. So clearly a lot of work still to do.
The BBC's Gideon Long joining us from Santiago. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tea time. It's not something you can really ignore when you work with a bunch of Brits, as we do here at The World. But Resham Galatly and Zach Marks have taken tea time to a much higher level. They were both on Fulbright scholarships in India when they met 2 years ago, and during their time there, they became fascinated with tea vendors. They're known as chai wallahs in India, and they're everywhere. So Resham and Zach decided to crisscross the country to talk with chai wallahs and their customers. We reached Resham and Zach in New Delhi today, and Resham told me what was surprising to them at first was the diversity of customers at the tea stalls.
So at one stand, you might find a businessman next to an auto rickshaw driver, next to a college student. And it's one of the places in India that it's very rare to see such mixing. It's a very stratified society otherwise, by caste or socioeconomic status or religion. But a chai stand is one place where all of these differences melt away over a cup of chai. So we thought that was very unique.
For us, you know, it was chai stands were really a gateway into communities. We would go to new places where we might not know anyone, but we would just saddle up to a chai stand and begin a conversation, and that's how we would learn about the neighborhood we were in or the new city we were visiting.
So take me into a typical tea stall. I mean, how does it all kind of go down? Is there a line when you get there?
Well, it really depends on the time of the day. So throughout a day, a tea stall experiences different waves of people, different waves of productivity and how busy they are. So sometimes you'll have a line, you know, first thing in the morning, there's often a morning rush as people are going to work. And the chaiwala around the clock never really stops working. So there might be a line, but the chaiwala is quickly churning out cup after cup after cup of milky sweet chai. Customers sometimes sit around, chat, read the newspaper. Others just gulp down the chai and get on their way.
And do Indians know the best tea stalls in their neighborhood? I mean, are there ones that are more popular than others?
Definitely. I think this journey has been possible for us because everywhere we go, we will ask someone, you know, where's the best chai that we can find here? And everyone will eagerly take you to their favorite chaiwala.
So I imagine a chaiwala is kind of like a bartender. They have great stories. They hear a lot of complaints from people, their rejoices. What's the best story a tea vendor ever told you?
So one of our favorite chaiwalas so far is at Delhi University, and his family has had this tea stall there for a couple of generations. They've seen students come and go over the years, and they've become a fixture on campus. So this chaiwala, whose name is Deepu, has a notebook that's filled with stories and poems and memories that his, you know, customers, former students, have written for him. And he keeps this notebook with him at all times. He was very eager to show it to us and proud of what his students have written about him. And
wow.
His students have come back year after year. And it really shows, you know, that he's not just a chaiwala to them. He's more a friend. There's no distinction there.
What was the best story he told you?
He had an amazing song that someone had written for him. And it was all about tea. And basically, I think the person was comparing their relationship with Deepu and his tea to falling in love at a chai stand. So we thought that was very poignant and sweet.
Now, like that man, the chaiwalas are usually men. Is that a new thing? Were women ever tea vendors?
That's a great question, and it really depends where you go. So in Delhi, we found nearly all the chaiwalas are men. You'll very rarely find a woman chaiwala, or chaiwali as a female chaiwala is called. Mm-hmm. But in Calcutta, which is a much more maybe female-friendly public space, we found a lot of chaiwalis, and they were there not with their husbands or sons or any male presence, just running their own businesses on their own. So that was really encouraging to see.
So I gather Starbucks has entered the Indian market. I'm just curious, what's the cost of a latte compared to a cup of chai?
About 10 cents for a cup of chai on the street, but a chai tea latte at Starbucks will run you something like 100 rupees.
100, 150.
Maybe even more, yeah. So there's a real great contrast there. We had an interesting encounter where we went to the Starbucks here in Delhi, and we asked the waiters there whether they preferred the chai at Starbucks or the ones outside, and they said, no, it's no question. Of course, we take our chai breaks outside. And so then we went out and had a chai with the waiter on his work break.
And we even had a chai with the manager who came out to the chaiwala and shared a cup with us there.
No kidding. That's wild. I mean, it may have already answered my next question. A lot of upwardly mobile Indians were waiting with bated breath for that Starbucks. I'm just wondering, does Starbucks pose any threat to the culture of tea vendors in India? Could they eventually?
It's not just Starbucks, but there are a few other coffee chains such as Cafe Coffee Day that have become really trendy. You know, they're air conditioned, they have Wi-Fi, young people can go there, guys and girls can hang out together. But largely, people have told us that they don't think that's ever going to happen. Chai is so integral to the culture that we don't see it going anywhere anytime soon, hopefully.
So what makes for you, Resham and Zach, a really good cup of chai? I mean, can you reproduce it?
Well, my favorite cup of chai is my mom's chai. So I'm half Indian, and I grew up with her making me chai every single morning. So I'm obviously partial to that taste. But the chaiwalas here do it a little bit differently. They boil the tea with the milk, and they bring it to a boil 5 or 6 times.
Well, and of course, all the sugar they use makes
yes.
it extra special.
Right.
The chai here, it's often, it's like, would you like some tea with your milk and sugar?
Yeah.
Resham Galatli and Zach Marks in New Delhi telling us about their adventures in Chai Land in India. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
And you can see pictures and a video of chaiwallahs at work at PRI.org. Milk and sugar are extra. Now a story about a cultural tradition in Cambodia that seemed to disappear but is getting some new life. Musicians there are trying to revive some ancient instruments like the Cambodian harp. Until recently, no one had even heard the sound of it or seen one for hundreds of years. Erwin Loy has a story.
In this rehearsal studio, a group of young musicians is grappling with the sounds of a distant era. In front, one musician sits on the floor, wrapped around an ornate harp. He draws his fingers tentatively across the strings. It looks like a smaller version of a classic Western harp, but this one is curved like a boat. Its neck stretches up from the ground in a flowing arc. That's Patrick Kersalet. He's a French ethnomusicologist who's worked in Asia for more than 20 years. That work has taken him to countries with rich cultural traditions, but also long turbulent histories. Sometimes pieces of that culture vanish over time.
This instrument disappeared maybe after 13th century, 14th century. Nobody knows.
This year, Kersalet helped to reintroduce a part of Cambodia's lost musical heritage, the pan or harp. Even though it vanished, its image remained, recorded on bas-reliefs, sculptures carved into the walls of some of Cambodia's cherished temples and monuments. Kersalet started by tracing out the shape of the harp. He studied inscriptions that might shed light on how the harps were made and used. Cambodia's musical tradition is a story of survival through catastrophic decline, both distant and modern. The Khmer Empire was once the region's most powerful, but its collapse ushered in centuries of decay. And the brutal rule of Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge in the late 1970s saw many musical forms pushed to the brink.
Because now the problem when you ask people, oh, how old is music? Oh, it's very old, before Pol Pot. So the people, they don't know how old is music, so I would like to help them to know their culture, because the music is very alive.
One Cambodian craftsman trying to keep that music alive is Khao Sanon Kavai. Kersalet enlisted him to help rebuild the harp. Kavai is a leading craftsman making traditional Cambodian instruments here in his workshop, like the ronit, a type of xylophone. Kavai learned his skills from his father before him. Today, he's trying to pass on the tradition to his own children. When Kavai finished building the harp, the first one to play it was his 14-year-old daughter, Sarai Rot. Now, she started harp lessons.
These are Cambodian instruments. I want all Cambodians to be able to see them and hear them again.
Still, the harp's place in today's Cambodia is far from certain. Hum Sopi is a Cambodian composer who comes from a long line of musicians. He's thrilled that the harp has returned, but he doesn't want it to become some historical curiosity, admired like a museum piece. That's why he's composing new music for this old instrument.
We have to think about how this instrument can continue to live. If no people play your harp, maybe you only put in the museum. I think it's more interesting if somebody will play.
Back in the rehearsal studio, some of that work is starting. The musicians are playing some of the instruments Kersalet has rebuilt, including these metal trumpets, based on depictions of a military orchestra found at the famed Angkor Wat Temple. These long-lost sounds have been brought back to life. What remains to be seen is whether they will thrive in today's Cambodia or be living relics of another era carved into an ancient wall. For The World, I'm Erwin Loy in Phnom Penh.
Still ahead on the show, we spin the calendar back to summer with our guest DJ from Norway setting the mood. That's just ahead on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom, in theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you lived in one of the rebel-held communities that ring Damascus in Syria, you might feel like a noose has been dropped around your neighborhood. Syria's regime is putting a squeeze on many opposition strongholds, making it more difficult for residents to move in and out and get basic supplies like food and medicine. Yesterday, though, the noose was relaxed just a bit in Muadamiya, a rebel-held community southwest of Damascus. The government allowed some 500 women, children, and elderly residents to leave. Wall Street Journal correspondent Sam Dagger is in Damascus. He says most rebel-controlled areas around the capital are definitely feeling the heat.
There has been shelling on a town called Daraya, which is next door to Muadamiya. And I saw that with my own eyes, you know, just being on the highway and being able to see it from the car. And Muadamiya itself, it seems like there's a tense calm now. And it seems like the government is trying to give these rebels in Muadamiya an ultimatum. You know, either do you want to surrender or do you want us to go in and storm the town and gain control of it that way? So I think there are some tense negotiations now. The government is trying to force these rebels in Muadamiya to surrender.
So give us a snapshot. What do these neighborhoods look like right now?
The government has besieged a lot of these areas and is pounding these areas with artillery rockets and dropping bombs by air on almost a daily basis. So it's very dangerous to go into these areas. And plus, it's almost impossible. I mean, I'll have to be smuggled into these areas. Hezbollah is involved here in Damascus as well. And it's working with the regime on clearing a lot of these suburban areas from the rebels. So they're completely sealed off. There's usually one or two checkpoints through which people are allowed to go in and out. And once you drive around what's called here the flyover that goes around the city, the highway, you're able to see the bombardment on these rebel enclaves, whether of aerial bombardment or artillery. You actually hear the explosions. You see the smoke go up in a lot of these areas around the city. So it's a real war in a lot of these areas around the city.
It sounds so checkerboard from one neighborhood to another. How can a city live this way without at some point just getting torn apart?
It has been torn apart, Marco. It's amazing. You're dealing with two different realities here. I can't get over it myself. I've been here for about a year, and I've seen this situation happen over the past year as the regime has been able to seal off these rebellious areas and has been able to, you know, separate them completely from the city. It's almost two different realities.
I mean, it's interesting. You were just talking about getting food and medicine to these neighborhoods. I mean, you've described how in months past, rebel sympathizers from elsewhere in Damascus would drive by these opposition strongholds and just chuck the grocery bags of food out the car windows and move on. Is that sort of thing still happening?
Not anymore, because government forces at the time realized what was going on, so they completely sealed off Muadamiya. And you have to remember, there are other areas as well that are suffering, particularly directly south of the city. There is the Palestinian refugee camp, which is called Yarmouk, and some adjacent neighborhoods like Yalda and Al-Hajar al-Aswad. And these areas are completely besieged by government forces. We've heard reports that clerics in these neighborhoods south of Damascus have issued what amounts to religious edicts, fatwas, that allow people to eat cats and dogs in order to fend off the threat of starvation.
When was the last time you were able to get into these rebel neighborhoods and towns, Sam?
Recently, I was able to get to another area northwest of the city called Kutsaya. And that's a very interesting area because it was restive about a year ago, and the government completely snuffed out the opposition there and was able to declare it cleansed, quote unquote, from all rebel activity. The main sort of street, the market street, you could see, you know, anti-government and anti-Assad graffiti scrolled on shop fronts, on walls.
Sounds like despair and disillusionment.
There's a fair amount of disillusionment and anger with both sides of the conflict.
Wall Street Journal correspondent Sam Dagger in Damascus, Syria. Thanks for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
We're a long way from summer now, but in Oslo, Norway, a few days with highs in the 50s is apparently enough to break out the shorts and flip-flops, at least according to our guest DJ today.
Howdy, folks. This is Marius Asp from NRK in Oslo, Norway, reporting to you from a capital where the last scraps of summer are still lingering, which gives me the opportunity to recommend what might be the best summer album from Norway in recent years. My Son, the debut album by the folk-pop duo Mona and Maria. This is the opening title track.
Love
music history is full of gorgeous vocal harmonizing, not the least from the heydays of the folk scene in Laurel Canyon during the late 60s and early 70s. Mona and Maria, whose full names are Mona Andersson and Maria Knudsen, place themselves in this tradition, as it ranges from the Byrds to Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. An example of great Byrdsian jangle pop is found in the album's by far most upbeat and guitar-driven moment, the single Silent Summer. Obviously, there are a lot of artists and bands tapping into this golden era of the American West Coast right now. Not all of them manage to renew the tradition or transform their influences into an original sound. The reasons Mona and Maria do are as subtle as the music itself. Sometimes an eeriness creeps into their voices, like clouds on an otherwise blue summer sky. The same can be said for the arrangements, elegant and subdued, but effective and often with hints of dissonance. Add to that a handful of great songs, and the impressive debut album by Mona and Maria just might be a future summer classic. Here's one last taste. This one's called Let the Light.
Our elegant and subdued guest DJ, Marius Asp, wraps up the show today. You can listen to another Mona and Maria song, Silent Summer, at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org, the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.